KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting in progress. For this week's public health updates, held as a virtual meeting during the pandemic, Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Allison Berry and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
Commissioner District redistricting, which is really our wheelhouse, our job description in this process. And then redrawing of precincts will happen after the commissioner districts are settled on. There is going to be some consideration of precincts as we move through the commissioner district redrawing, just because we don't want to split precincts and make the map more confusing than we need to. So that's just that on redistricting, and stay tuned for sunrising on that on the commissioner agenda in the next couple of weeks. I think that's enough.
Carolyn here. Kate, as a co-host, can you bring people over? I'm going to have to restart my Zoom computer. My screen is frozen and I'm unable to bring a panelist over.
Sure. Yeah. All right. It is 9:45, so we have KPTZ joining us. Bear with me as I work on bringing over. Welcome to Dr. Berry, our health officer, and to Willie Bentz from Department of Emergency Management. We'll hand it off to you first, Dr. Berry. Welcome. And any good news for us this week?
I actually do have some good news for you guys. So starting as we usually do with national trends, so nationwide, we're continuing to see really a regional pattern. The South is seeing a significant decrease in cases, though, because their initial peak was so high, they actually have just now decreased that we are currently at. So that massive decrease is just from a very, very high peak. The Northeast and the Midwest, and particularly Appalachia, are seeing cases rise. They didn't have as significant of a spike in the early round of infections. And Alaska is currently leading the country with new infections. And you guys probably saw in the news a new declaration of crisis standards of care in Alaska. On the West side of things, we are starting to see a slow decrease in cases throughout the West Coast. In Washington State in particular, we're largely seeing a plateau with the suggestion of a possible early decrease statewide, but that also is regional. So we're seeing kind of through the Puget Sound area, a small decrease in cases. On the east side of the mountains, still an increase in cases. But the good news is that actually Jefferson and Clallam are leading the way with some of the largest decreases in cases that we have seen, and the largest decreases in hospitalization as well. So Jefferson County case rates are down 41% in the last week, and Clallam County is down 35%. And so we really are leading the way as far as reductions. Current Jefferson case rate, which is a two-week case rate, so that's why it's you'll see a little bit of a lag there, is 275 cases per 100,000. We currently have no COVID-positive inpatients at Jefferson Healthcare for the first time in quite some time. There are two of our citizens who are currently hospitalized at out-of-county hospitals, but that's a massive decrease from where we were before. In Clallam County, the case rate is also decreasing down to 849 per 100,000. That is, of course, still very, very high, but it is down significantly from where we were. And there are currently 8 people in hospital in Clallam County, which is down from a peak of 21. So the region is certainly improving, really led by our area. Kitsap County is starting to see a decrease. They're at 548 cases per 100,000, so still relatively tight. And as far as hospital access, we are starting to see a little bit of opening up, but not a lot at the state level. So we have 45 available ICU beds in the state. So really the overall trend you're seeing is a small improvement at the state level and a much more rapid improvement out here. Interestingly, the Institute for Health Metrics actually just put out a study looking at the effect of requirements for vaccine, for proof of vaccination for restaurants and bars. Particularly, they were modeling the King County mandate, which is based on ours. And they did find that it has a very significant effect on reducing COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. And I believe that, along with our masking requirements, is really driving our significant reduction in cases out here. So that is very hopeful progress from our end. The other major news was looking at the announcement of boosters. So that came out on Friday. So the CDC did approve booster doses for people who got the Pfizer vaccine. If they had it sit, so 6 months after their last dose, if you are over 65, if you are a resident in long-term care, if you have a medical condition that puts you at high risk of severe complications from COVID-19 and you are over 18, or if you are a high-risk worker, so particularly focusing on healthcare workers there, but other frontline workers are also eligible. And that's only if you've had a Pfizer vaccine. There are no recommendations yet for boosters for the other vaccines, but those are likely coming down the pike. We anticipate in the next month or so that we would likely hear more about those. And I know Willie will talk a lot more about the mass vaccinations planning and how we make sure everybody has access to these boosters. Late Friday, they got approved by the Western States Conference and also by the Washington State Department of Health. So they are now approved, and we'll talk about kind of the best ways to go about getting vaccinated locally. I did want to touch base on a little bit around vaccination. We hear a lot about vaccines in the news and in the public. And so I wanted to speak a little bit to some of the data and dispel a little bit of confusion around vaccines as well. So one of the common misconceptions I hear is that, well, people who are vaccinated can spread the virus. So it's pretty much equal. You know, people who are vaccinated are just as likely to spread it as people who are not. And that's just not true. So looking at the actual data, so the vaccines, while they have had some decrease in efficacy with the rise of the Delta variant, are still incredibly effective at preventing any infection at all. So we are still seeing, depending on the study, between 74 and 88% effectiveness at preventing COVID-19. So if you are vaccinated, you're less likely to have the virus, which means you can't give it to other people. And then even if you are unlikely enough to get one of those breakthrough infections, then we see that you have lower amounts of viable virus that you could transmit to other people. And you also are infectious for a shorter period of time. So 3 days as opposed to 10. All those things come together to make you less likely to transmit the virus. I also have heard from folks who are worried about potential side effects from the vaccine. So I wanted to touch base on a couple key ones that I hear about a lot. One of them is myocarditis. So that one, there is an association. It's very, very rare, but there is an association with the vaccines and myocarditis, the mRNA vaccines in particular. But I think one of the key things that we haven't talked enough about is there is a much stronger association between getting COVID-19 and myocarditis. So when we see young people die of COVID-19, the number one thing they're dying of there is myocarditis. You are 54 times more likely to get myocarditis from COVID-19 itself than you are from a COVID-19 vaccine. So if you are worried about getting myocarditis, the number one best way to prevent that actually is getting vaccinated for COVID-19. Similarly, I hear a concern about Guillain-Barré, which is a rare neurologic disorder that has been associated with vaccines. But it is actually much more strongly associated with viral infections. So, and it is strongly associated with COVID-19 as well. So if you get COVID-19, you are 188 times more likely to get Guillain-Barré than from the vaccine. So if you are worried about both of those rare complications, they're dramatically more likely if you get COVID-19 than if you get the vaccine itself. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions from our commissioners. Or actually, before I jump to questions, how about I go a little out of order and jump to Willie to talk about our vaccination planning, since we're talking a lot about vaccine.
Thank you, Dr. Barry. So with the announcement that booster doses are available, we have three mass clinics that are on the schedule. The first of which is going to be Saturday, October 9th. That'll be at Blue Heron in Port Townsend. The second of which is October 16th at the Chimicum School District Multipurpose Building. And then finally, we'll be down in Quilcene at the Quilcene School gym on October 23rd. We have about 600 spots available in each mass clinic. And depending on the response, we can expand those to a little over 700. 600 are available for now. To sign up for those, sign-ups open tomorrow at 9 a.m. The links will be posted on the Jefferson County Public Health website, or you can call us here at the EOC, 360-344-9791. And the phone has been ringing and ringing and ringing the past couple of days since the announcement. We are staffed from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Prior to this week, we had gone down to a model where you would leave a message and we'd call you back within 24 hours. And we were seeing a lot of people calling multiple times and never leaving a voicemail. We are staffed up now. We can take your calls here. So feel free to give us a ring. Just do have patience with us as we are expecting to be fielding a lot of calls from a lot of folks who are anxious to get a spot in line. Just know that we do have, again, a little over 2,000 with these initial run of mask clinics. Mark, you had a question or a thought?
Yeah, I'm eligible for that booster. So do I have to call and get a time or do I just show up and wait in line? How's that work?
So appointments are required for these first couple of clinics. So either sign up through the link on the Jefferson Public Health site, again, starting tomorrow at 9 a.m. The clinics will run 9 to noon and then 1 to 4. So there'll be a little bit of a lunch break in the middle there with 300 spots available on either side. Or if you want, again, you can just call us and we can help you find it. Going online is a little bit preferred, again, since our phone operators here, our volunteer call takers will be pretty busy with the initial onslaught. Again, those will all go live tomorrow at 9 a.m. Now, some of the local pharmacies will be offering booster doses as well. But when we talked to them on Friday, I had mentioned last week, kind of preparing for this moment, you know, we all heard about the approval the same time you all did. We were all reading the same news articles. This was all happening in real time. So, you know, we were fortunate. We were pre-planning. We had these clinics kind of in our pocket, ready to go. But a lot of the local pharmacies, specifically the large corporate ones, are waiting for guidance from corporate headquarters. So they weren't ready to make announcements or schedule appointments quite yet as of Friday. But once they have their programs up and running, we'll make sure that information gets posted on the Jefferson County Public Health website. And we'll make sure our call takers have that information too to help you get an appointment with one of the local pharmacies there. Now, as part of the announcement, again, you have to be 65 plus or 50 to 64 with an underlying medical condition. Those conditions will be listed again on the public health website, or we can answer your questions via the call center. Now, those are the two population groups the CDC recommended should get the booster shot. There were additional groups that they allowed that may get the booster shot. That includes folks 18 to 49 with one of those underlying conditions, as well as folks whose occupational or institutional setting puts them at high risk for contracting COVID-19. So things like healthcare workers, grocery store workers, teachers, things like that. Our first three mass clinics are going to be focused on the former, those first two groups that I mentioned, 55 plus, 50 to 64 with an underlying condition. Those were the folks that the CDC identified as priorities. That's who we're going to be prioritizing first in our large clinics. However, for those folks in an occupational setting, right now we're working with Jefferson Healthcare to set up private clinics for their staff. We're going to be working with the first responder community to set up some private, smaller clinics targeted at those folks. So we're going to be working with them to not put them at the mass care clinic, but actually bring the vaccine to them and help them knock out some of their employees. For the 18 to 49, we understand a lot of folks are going to want and need the vaccine. We'll make an announcement if and when our mass care clinics are open up to those populations, if we schedule additional clinics, but you also will likely be able to go to pharmacies. So do look out there. And again, all else fails, call us here at the EOC and we can walk you through your options. But right now, that's what we have on the docket. We're super busy. These three big clinics, we're still wrapping up a few clinics this week to help employers meet that October 18th deadline to get their individuals vaccinated as part of the state mandate. We're setting up these smaller private clinics, and we stand awaiting and at the ready for if and when Moderna or J&J gets approved for booster doses. We're also expecting 5 to 11-year-olds to get approved for Pfizer as well next month. So we're going to do our best to try to hit everyone, but now, right now, the hospital short-staffed and overwhelmed, public health short-staffed and overwhelmed. So we here at DEM are doing what we can to get as many folks as possible. So bear with us. We'll make sure everyone has access. Call us if you need help. But that's what's on the schedule now. And last but not least, I do want to mention, if you make an appointment, then you should be 6 months out from your last second dose of Pfizer. And please bring your vaccine card with you to your appointment. So schedule your appointment, and then right when you get done, please dig up your vaccine card. You likely have a picture of it or something on your phone to be able to go in restaurants, but we would really like to have that physical card. So make sure to go dig that out and bring that with you. Commissioner Brotherton?
Yeah, you kind of answered my question. I just want to make sure we're explicit. If I'm over 65 and I had the Moderna the first time, I should wait.
Correct. This is for folks who received Pfizer only, and you will receive Pfizer again. Right now, we're not mixing vaccines. A booster dose for those who got Moderna is likely coming, but it's unfortunately not here yet. So this is for Pfizer only.
Great. Thanks. You guys are good at dialing it up fast now.
Hey, Willie. So my vaccine card photo is right there. Is that good?
We need the physical. So you know how you have your vaccine information scribbled in? We actually need that physical card with you at your appointment so we can add your booster dose information.
Okay, got it.
And if it's actually lost, we'll help you replace it if you bring us a picture. But our preference, just because every little one of those actually slows down our ability to do 600 that day. So it's sure. So much faster if people bring
that. Right. Well, I guess I better start looking for that thing.
And that's why I'm giving everyone a heads up now. It's in a week or two, but start looking now just in case.
And I did speak to Jefferson Healthcare this morning, and they wanted me to make sure to let everyone know that they are available to support their patients if anyone has access issues, if coming to one of these places is, one of these mass clinics is not accessible to you. But they are hoping that this will be the primary place where folks use for a little while, because as we've discussed, they are still, even though we've gotten to the point where we don't have anyone hospitalized with COVID-19, they are still really stretched thin. And so we'd like to prioritize them managing the other medical issues and really get the vaccinations through Department of Emergency Management. They're going to start bringing back some surgeries and things that have been put off. And so they're going to have their hands full over there.
Talk a little bit about why there's a booster just for Pfizer.
So yes, the primary driver and also drives the idea around prioritization is the data around Pfizer and Moderna. So we are starting to see a loss of efficacy in specifically Pfizer and in people over 75. That's the group where we're starting to see some fading of vaccine efficacy. We're not actually seeing significant fading in these younger groups. But because we are seeing such extensive transmission, the CDC decided it was prudent to improve vaccine coverage for these high-risk groups as well, even though we're not really seeing fading efficacy of their vaccine. So part of that is that really the data supports boosters more with Pfizer than with the other vaccines right now. And also just that they have had the Pfizer data to review. The Moderna data has not fully been reviewed yet. We anticipate it will be soon, and that we are likely to see boosters in that group. But if you are not yet recommended for a booster because you got Moderna or J&J, just know that your vaccine is still really, really good. It still makes a difference in reducing your risk of catching COVID, of transmitting COVID, of getting hospitalized or of dying due to COVID-19. But we are still seeing a lot of transmission in our community. So please do wear a mask in those indoor settings. And that should keep you well protected.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question, but I don't want to interrupt your flow, Willie.
The end of my report. So any questions you have, go for it.
I wonder, do we know if that loss of efficacy is leading to our relatively high breakthrough case rate, or any other reason you can point to that we have a higher than average breakthrough case rate?
So the primary driver of our high breakthrough case rate is actually just the percentage of our population that's vaccinated. So it's just kind of a math issue. We have a higher breakthrough rate, but we have a lower case number. So one of the places where you'll see folks kind of get a little bit confused with the data is looking at some of the very vaccinated countries in Europe, and they have really high breakthrough rates, but their actual case rate is shockingly low. So if you're looking at, people talk about Iceland has a really high breakthrough rate, 80% of their cases are in vaccinated people, but their case rate is about 17. So if we got that here, we would declare this over. So when you see really high rates of vaccination, you see lower rates of COVID-19, but those rare cases are more likely to be vaccinated because that's the majority of people, but the risk is still higher if you are unvaccinated. But if you have a larger population in the vaccinated group, you're going to see more cases among them because there are just more of them. So that's the biggest driver we see in Jefferson. But the other drivers, smaller, less contributory, but likely part of it, is that we do have an older population. So our older population is less able to mount an immune response generally, and they also got vaccinated with Pfizer early on. And so all of those variables together are going to contribute to breakthrough. So definitely, if you are over 75 and you got vaccinated with Pfizer, I do recommend you get a booster. Those other groups, it's a little bit more of a, you may get a booster. CDC is recommending for 50 plus with underlying conditions and 65 plus generally. And I think that's a reasonable assessment for everybody else. Your vaccine actually is still really good, unless you have an underlying immunosuppressing condition.
I will add to that. One of the comments from one of the ACIP members who actually, approved the booster doses had noted, we're not going to boost our way out of this pandemic. Our priority still is getting the unvaccinated vaccinated. Though for those 75 plus year old folks, this is a really important step to offer them additional protection. But as Dr. Berry said, for the rest of the folks who were recommended or allowed to receive the booster dose, it's more of a just in case type option. So again, our first priority, getting the unvaccinated vaccinated. Second to that, protecting those 75 plus year olds, because this will offer some additional protection. The rest, it's just a precautionary measure. So it's recommended, but not as vital as it was to get the vaccine in.
And do we have other questions from our commissioners?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Berry. Not a lot of questions today, but I'm just wondering if you can give us the pulse of how it's going in the school districts around Jefferson County, whether we, yeah.
Yes, I apologize. That was supposed to be a standing update and I didn't do it. So part of the reason why is that there's actually not a lot of news there. So we continue to not have any cases of in-school transmission of COVID-19, so in-classroom transmission. We have had one more sports team affected, but other than that, we're really not seeing significant transmission related to school activities. I did have a good meeting with the superintendents last Tuesday, and we really talked about doubling down on clear messaging on masking related to sports. One of the things that we've definitely seen is children mask as well as the adults around them expect them to. And so if our coaches are very clear that this is an expectation of play, that you will be masked when you're in indoor space, including in the locker room, including when you're on the bus, the kids do fine with wearing it. But if we don't make that expectation clear, and certainly if we don't demonstrate it ourselves, kids are more likely to not wear their masks. So that's kind of where we're starting there. And so far we've seen improvements in adherence to masking in those areas. Still a lot of contact tracing, and that is a significant strain on the school staff. And it's near exclusively cases that are happening in the community, but that kids get from usually their parents. And so the schools are working really hard to contact trace and make sure that we catch those infections quickly and make sure that we don't get spread in school. But it is that is still a significant strain for them. But otherwise, all of our schools in Jefferson are doing an incredible job at following the protocols, and it's really paying off. So I just want to thank our teachers, our administrators, and our kids and our parents who are following the rules, because it is making all the difference in keeping schools safe.
Great. And then just my last question, I promise, to follow up on that, wondering about capacity of public health and even Jefferson Healthcare. I know that it's going down a little bit, and it's great that we don't have anyone that's in the hospital with COVID, but how are we doing? I know they were actually managed to hire a couple people with public health, and I'm wondering, how's our staff doing and the other first responders?
It's still a significant strain. This was the first weekend that Jefferson Healthcare didn't have COVID patients. And so they're, cautiously breathing a sigh of relief for a minute, but they still have so much work to do. They have all this backlog of significant illness and people who need surgeries. So it's not easy yet, but it's certainly moving in the right direction. When it comes to public health, we are still really strained. You know, these case rates are better than they were, but they're still very, very high as far as, you know, the ability of us to trace these cases. So what we'll see first is we will scale back the triaging of cases so we can get more and more back to traditional contact tracing as these numbers get back into more reasonable levels. So our work doesn't decrease. We're just able to do more of it and do it more effectively. But we are, you know, doing the best we can to support the staff and help them through this strain, make sure they do, you know, try to put things down at the end of the day. I know when I left the office this last week, I had to remind all of the contact tracers that it was an hour and a half past closing and it's time to go home. We're doing the best we can to remind folks of that and support them. But there is still a pretty significant strain on public health at this point.
Thank you.
I have one question.
Yeah.
Kate reported a couple of weeks ago that COVID had come closer to her with friends experiencing breakthrough cases. And I'm just wondering, I've had the same thing, close personal friends, both doctors in Seattle, with a 2-year-old, both got COVID over the last week and, both vaccinated. So, you know, it, when it hits you that close to home, you go, how many of these cases are breakthrough cases? Do we have a sense of how many of the cases in our community or on our peninsula or in our state are breakthrough cases? I have heard a few. I wanted to ask you because I've heard a few different, very different numbers from each other. So
in Jefferson County at this point, our breakthrough percentage is 24%. So, you know, relatively high breakthrough rate, but as we discussed the math of how that comes to be. And one of the key things that we see there is the predominant driver of breakthrough is if you're a household contact. And so if you are vaccinated and say you have a child who brings it home, that actually is one of the ways that it happens. Or if you're in a really high exposure risk profession, like being a physician in a COVID pandemic. So that can happen. And so that's why I do support that the CDC move forward with boosters for healthcare workers. I think that makes a lot of sense. That's a critically high risk group, and losing them to work while they are positive is very challenging. I think the other key thing to remember is that these infections, when they do happen, tend to be much milder. And so instead of, you know, that 2-year-old losing a parent, they have a parent who has a cold or the flu for a week. And that really makes all the difference. But we also are seeing lots of cases where it actually breaks the chain of transmission. So and even in those cases, usually it does. So if you're unvaccinated, often what happens is the parents would get it. And before they realized it, they also went to work and gave it to a whole bunch of patients. And so then you get a terrible outbreak from that. Instead, what we get now is two parents who maybe had a cold or like one of them lost their sense of smell, and then they're fine. And no one else gets it and it stops. And so that's the other power of it is, you know, keeping those folks well and breaking that chain of transmission thereafter.
Thanks. I just wanted to hold that question up again because I'm getting it a lot. And I know the 24% number, but I just feels like it's happening more and more.
Well, and it, you know, I think part of it also is we do, you know, unfortunately kind of self-segregate, right? And so our vaccinated folks hang out together. And so when we hear of anyone getting COVID when they're vaccinated, that really stands out in your brain versus if you get COVID and you're unvaccinated, we don't hold on to that in our brain as much as we used to. But you know, one of the things that I am kind of unofficially monitoring in Clallam is the number of young parents we have lost to COVID who now have kids who don't have parents. And that is exclusively unvaccinated young people who that's happened to. And we are not seeing that in our vaccinated population.
I have one follow-up question.
Yeah.
Last week, I got a couple of phone calls from parents of students in school who've, you know, witnessed, have seen kids sitting close to each other at lunch, eating, mm-hmm. and just having that kind of, you know, concern because they're, you know, should they be commenting to the school? Is that okay? You know, and so I said, we've been hearing Dr. Barry say week after week that outside is very low transmission and we're not concerned about that, but they're still pressing on with the concern. about kids sitting 2 feet from each other on the playground or, you know, in front of the school eating their lunches.
So it is still true. Outdoor transmission is very, very rare, but in the vast majority of cases, masking is not necessary in an outdoor space, with the rare exception of very large gatherings, very close together. So, fairs, concerts, football games, things like that. For kids eating lunch together outside, it is still really low risk. We have not had a single case of transmission in that setting, in an outdoor setting like that. And we monitor for it. And we do quarantine kids' close friends if they're unvaccinated. And we still aren't seeing transmission if their only exposure was outside. I think the other thing to know there is that everything we're doing is to reduce risk. We can never make it zero if that kid's leaving their house. But what we find is, kids do need each other and they need socialization. And so one of the things we're trying to do is make that socialization as safe as possible. They're tiny humans that need emotional support. And so allowing them to sit near their friends outside is a very low risk intervention, which has a lot of benefit.
Thank you.
And Heidi, we do report the number of breakthrough cases on our data dashboard on our public health website. So you can track that pretty easily too. Hey, any other questions for Dr. Berry or Willie?
I can go through the KPTZ ones if you guys are ready. Oh, yeah, Willie.
Jump in real quick. I misspoke earlier. October 9th, we will be in Chimicum, and then October 16th at Blue Heron and PT. I flipped those two around. So Chimicum first in the school district multipurpose room on the 9th, then at Blue Heron in PT on the Saturday, the 16th. So apologies for that. I just wanted to make sure that was right.
And Willie, are any of those with the state vaccination mobile that was here this weekend, or is that separate?
That was totally separate. That was a offer by state DOH just to help continue some outreach to some of our vulnerable population groups. These two clinics will be DEM and public health, just like the previous mass clinics.
Okay. And do we know if the state DOH one is coming back?
Not at this point in time. We are requesting some assistance from them, specifically to help the campaign for 5 to 11-year-olds that's coming up at any given point. But right now, these first few clinics will be just us locals working together. The state, they have the whole state to worry about, and they've been kind enough to offer assistance here and there. But at this point in time, I don't know if they're coming back in the immediate future.
Thank you.
So moving on to questions from KPTZ listeners. So one is from a listener who heard that someone placed a relative at a long-term care facility and then found out there was an outbreak there. And so wondering about whether or not we should make the locations of COVID-19 outbreaks in long-term care public. As we've, I think, probably touched on before, we are very cautious with sharing information about our COVID-19 cases, particularly if it identifies where they live or where they work. We do really rely on the public trusting us with that information, so we do guard it very carefully. And in long-term care, we can really trace those quite well, and we control that environment. So we prevent other people from coming in, things like that. What I would say is I'm not familiar with this particular case, but it is a CMS and a DOH requirement that a facility that has a COVID-19 outbreak does have to disclose it to anyone who is being admitted to that facility. So if that did not happen, if there was a failure in communication there where someone was admitted and not alerted to the fact that they were being admitted to a facility that had an outbreak, that deserves a report to the local ombudsman to really investigate that situation, because that is a formal requirement of any long-term care facility admitting while in outbreak status. Sometimes potentially it could be that the person was admitted slightly before the outbreak happened or something like that. But if there was really someone admitted during an active outbreak who wasn't notified, that deserves a report to DSHS. One question, got a couple of questions around getting vaccinated for COVID-19 as boosters become available and the flu. So a good reminder, we are prepping for the flu season. We do anticipate it will be a rougher flu season than it was last year. And so we do encourage everyone to go out and get your flu shot as soon as it is available. And it is starting to become available in our community. So please do access it as it becomes available for you. There is no requirement to space it from your COVID-19 vaccine. You can get them at the same time. So say you're going to the pharmacy to get your booster and you notice they have flu shots too, just get them both because it will make a big difference. There's a small increased chance that you'll have a fever, for example, in the 24 hours after you get your vaccine, but that's nothing dangerous, very common known reaction. And it's very safe and you'll get the same response from your vaccines if you do that. Question was about determining the timing of a booster shot. So just to reiterate, 6 months after your second dose of Pfizer, if you're coming for a Pfizer booster shot, they are continuing to analyze the data around potentially mixing and the Moderna doses. And so we will keep you up to date as approvals come in from that. One person noted that they were in a local store and they heard an employee tell a friend that she was less than 24 hours from a trip out of state and she wasn't wearing her mask. Well, should I be concerned? And this person is fully vaccinated. I would say, you know, out of state travel does increase risk of transmission of COVID-19 or of contracting COVID-19. But there's a lot of variables that I don't know about this interaction and that you are unlikely to know too. So is this person fully vaccinated? I don't know. What I would say is in any interactions in indoor spaces right now, there is the possibility of COVID-19 transmission. The most important thing that you can do to reduce that transmission is you are vaccinated. So make sure you are fully vaccinated and that you're wearing a good mask. If you're around someone who's not masked, consider giving them a little more space. If you're around someone who's not masking well, it is actually okay to remind them very respectfully that your mask slipped a little bit and help them get it back up over their nose. The most common cause of that actually is that your loops are too loose. So if you're someone who your mask regularly slips down below your nose, if you tighten the ear loops, that'll stop happening. So you can mention that, but if it's a brief interaction, if you were masked, if you're fully vaccinated, that's pretty low risk. And so I wouldn't lose any sleep over it. Let's see. One says, I hope we can strike a balance between folks getting upset at the medical political situation, which is scary to this 2-time vaccinated gentleman. What would the good doctor say to those in other counties urging the same proof of vaccination in restaurants? And I would encourage them to do it. So with the recent IHME report, we really do have evidence now that this is an effective intervention at reducing cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. We are starting to see that play out in our community. I do think it is a reasonable option to reduce transmission in any place that has high rates of transmission. And a good reminder, our plan is to revoke the order as soon as we get back stably into the moderate risk range. So cases less than 75 per 100,000 for 2 weeks, then we'll revoke the order. So it's a temporary order to handle high transmission situations. And I think it's a meaningful option, especially for places that are continuing to see cases rise and hospitals strained. Other things, question about approval of Moderna boosters and concern for kind of our long-term care facility residents. So some of our long-term care has really got primarily Moderna. I'd say the majority of long-term care residents got Pfizer, but some got Moderna and kind of how the timing of that will be. I'd say, whenever we talk about a booster, the first thing we need is we need to have the data that it's needed and the data that it's efficacious. And I would say the CDC is reviewing that constantly. And I think we will have a recommendation for boosters in all of our long-term care facility residents soon. As we've discussed on this call before, that is a group I am particularly worried about. And we will be happy to support vaccination efforts in our long-term care facilities as soon as there is a booster available to them and already for those who have access to the Pfizer vaccine. The only other question I got from a listener was about apparently their eye doctor didn't like being asked about their vaccination status and encouraged them to get a different provider. I would say providers do always have the ability to fire a patient, but I'm really sorry that happened. Medical providers do have, all medical providers are required to get vaccinated unless they have a valid medical or religious exemption. And so if there is a medical provider in our community who is not getting vaccinated and not following the order, they are risking their license and can be reported to their licensing board for that. And that's what I've got today. Any other questions from the team?
Any KPTZ questions for you, Willie?
Nope. As usual, all for the doctor.
Okay. Maybe I'll follow up something I've been thinking about a lot this weekend, Dr. Berry. There's one article about a couple of different modeling scenarios that showed a couple of different kind of likelihoods of kind of where are we going from here. And there was a headline on NPR that said we should be through this Delta business by March. And I was like, March, 6 months, a whole nother winter? Are you kidding? Like, this is not good news. But based on your experience and reading of the data, what would be your crystal ball read of kind of what the rest of the fall and winter look like locally?
I do actually, to some extent, agree with that article, unfortunately.
Darn it.
But I don't think it'll be, you know, consistent. It's not that we're going to hang here until March, but that if we keep doing the work that we're doing, we can really drive our cases down. But we are likely to see a holiday surge, unless people's behavior is dramatically different this year than it was last year. You know, people have a tendency to travel and gather for holidays. And so and come inside because it's cold. And so we do plan, you know, as part of our planning efforts, we plan for a sixth wave in the winter. But the better we get our case rates lower before that starts, and the better we get our vaccination rates before that starts, the lower that wave will be. So we can make that a bump as opposed to the kind of severe wave that we've seen, as long as we go into it with low case rates and we get as many of us vaccinated as possible. And if we wear our masks, so our masks will make a big difference in reducing additional cases and also reducing the flu. They're very effective against the flu. And so that can reduce the likelihood of a combined surge. But I do agree that I think we are likely to be through the worst of all of this by next spring.
So would that follow that you might guess that we would see hopefully a continued decline from now and then another spike in or another bump in kind of December, January, February due to the holidays, therefore exactly. March being okay.
And then the fade in March.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Berry. Thank you, Willie. Hope that you're getting some sleep and able to take care of yourselves. It's been a long haul. Sure you're all tired. So I'm certainly tired of COVID. We all are.
Thanks, guys. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too. We'll see you next week.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.